We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Our topic for today is one that is very close to myself and also the two colleagues of mine. We are going to be talking about addressing diversity, inclusion, and social justice in our changing and school communities. Okay, so as I said, my name is Dr. Flavia Yuspa. I'm an assistant teaching professor within the Department of Teaching and Learning at FIU. And with me, I have two panelists, which are my colleagues and friends, and I will ask them to please introduce themselves. I have Dr. Elizabeth Kramer and Dr. Maria Salikis. Dr. Kramer, if you can go first and introduce yourself, I will appreciate.
Sure. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Liz Kramer, and I am a professor of special education. I direct all the graduate programs within the Department of Teaching and Learning at Florida International University, and I also oversee our fully online master's in special education, which is related to the discussion we'll be having today.
Dr. Salikis, if you can go next, please.
Yes, thank you, Flavia. Hi, I'm Maria Salikis. I am elementary education program director, and I also am faculty lead for the MSCI curriculum and instruction in elementary education at FIU.
Thank you, Dr. Salikis. And I would also like to recognize that I have Marianne Brown with us, and she is our ASL interpreter. So thank you, Marianne. So I just wanted to give you some information about FIU so you know who we are. We are a public research university. We offer more than, I would say, 201 or more, if not bachelor, master's, and doctoral degree. Our enrollment is a large university. We have 57,000 students, more alumni. Of course, you can see 224 alumni. And what is interesting is that we are ranked number one in the nation as awarding bachelor's degree and master's degree for Hispanic students. We also are a research one university, which means that we are extremely research-oriented university. Our faculty are very good in providing research that makes a great contribution to their different areas. We have 20 years of excellence in online learning, since we do have experience in providing a variety of online master's degree. And you can see we have 100 and plus. And we also have 42,000 more students that take online classes. We recognize the time and that we live in, and therefore online has become an important part of how our faculty teaches. I would like to share with you, before we move on into the actual webinar, about the master's programs that we have online. Particularly, we have the curriculum and instruction, curriculum development program, fully online. I'm the faculty director for that program. And for that program, where we look at curriculum design, what are the theories, and how we make sure that provides curriculum that are available and for all our students in the classrooms. We also have the curriculum and instruction in elementary education, which Dr. Salikis is the faculty director, and she will eventually will provide some minor details. Maria, would you like to give a brief blurb about your program?
Sure. So the elementary education focuses on the K-6 classroom setting. It looks at a lot of issues and trends in elementary education, and it seeks to incorporate a lot of diversity issues with equity, access, and social justice.
Thank you. Great. Thank you, Maria. So we have the other programs, educational leadership, higher education administration, and the special education with autism endorsement, which Dr. Kramer, she's the faculty director. So Liz, would you like to say something briefly about the program?
Sure. This program prepares teachers who are already with some experience in special education to advance their knowledge and understanding of current research, current best practices, working with culturally and linguistically diverse learners and their families, with a particular emphasis on working with students who have autism. For those of our participants who live in the state of Florida, the completion of this degree program leads to the Florida State Autism Endorsement, which can be added to a certificate. For folks that are outside the state of Florida, there's some reciprocity on a case-by-case basis, but everybody would come away with 12 credits and a lot of expertise on students with autism.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kramer. Other minor details that I want to mention quickly, these programs are cohort-based, so they will be usually done between 12 or 16 months. There's no GRE requirements. There is limited scholarships available, which is being right now, that information being posted on the chat, so you can go and check that out. So let's start our conversation, shall we? Today we're going to be addressing changing schools communities. The three main topics or themes that we're going to be addressing are diversity, inclusion, and social justice. Now, it's important for us as we engage in this conversation that we try to provide some idea or some definition of what are these topics. So for diversity, we're going to be referring to the differences or different varieties of races, ethnicity, origins that we perhaps get to see in our classrooms' backgrounds. Inclusion, we are looking at that activities or the act that we do for integrating, accommodating, and including all diversity within our classrooms. And for social justice, it refers more to the type of pedagogy, is more oriented toward critical thinking. If you have read probably Paulo Freire, you are thinking about teaching for change and teaching for making sure that all the students can really obtain a future that is equitable for them. So I wanted to provide you with that background as we now go into the series of questions and answers. So the first question that we're going to be addressing today, it really lies into within the past several decades. We know that communities have evolved and become more diverse. So the first question that I would like to present and pose to the panelists is the following. So how would you describe the challenges for access and equity to public schools from the evolving communities, and how have they shaped the current school climate? So I will ask, please, Dr. Kramer, if she can provide us her response or her thoughts on that question.
Sure. Thank you, Flavia. And you're right. There has been a shift in demographics across our country over the last several years, and that shift is certainly occurring in our public school system. So enrollment overall in public schools has grown dramatically in the past 25 years, but it hasn't grown the same across different ethnic groups. To get these data, we tend to look at the National Center for Education Statistics, which is part of the Department of Education, Institute of Education Sciences. The last real look they took at this was in 2017, and they compared data over the past 25 years prior to that. And what they saw is there's a really big shift in the number of Hispanic or Latinx students enrolled in public schools. That's more than doubled over those 25 years, raising from 6 million students to 13.6 million students. And Hispanic students now make up over 26% of the total school population. We haven't seen other demographic groups raise at the same rate. In fact, we've seen a decrease in white and black students, with white students decreasing pretty rapidly over the overall percentage for the past 25 years. So in the fall of 2017, which was the last year they had these data, 24.1 million students were white, 7.7 million were Black, and 13.6 million were Hispanic. And then we have small percentages of Asian Pacific Islander, mixed race, other. So what we see in the projections as we look forward to the next 2029, is that we're expecting to see those trends increase. And we're expecting to see higher increases in Hispanic or Latinx students and decreases in most of the other populations. So along with that, not surprising when we're seeing a large increase in Hispanic and Latinx students is we're also seeing a pretty large increase in English learners or ESOL students, some people refer to them as. And this has increased from 8% to 10% of the total school population over the past 20 years. We do see certainly higher increases of English language learners in more urbanized areas versus rural areas. So those percentages are kind of skewed because the urban areas, the ratios are even higher. Here in Miami, for example, where myself and my colleagues are located, it's at about 20% in the public schools, English learners. We also see much higher rates of English learners in the lower grades, like in kindergarten and elementary grades. And by the time students enter high school, those numbers tend to decrease because they've learned English by that time. So, you know, this certainly affects the way we need to plan for our instruction. As I mentioned earlier, my background is special ed. And another major shift I think we've seen is in special ed laws that dictate how students access education and the equal opportunities for education. So back in the early 2000s, No Child Left Behind Act was passed. Later we authorized the ESSA Act, Every Student Succeeds Act. But really critical for special education, in 2004, we reauthorized the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And what happened with this is, although we always talked about having students with disabilities included in general education classrooms to the fullest extent possible, the new laws really required that students were given every consideration to be included in general education classrooms. And for those of you who have been in the classroom for a long time, I'm sure you've seen an increase in numbers of students with disabilities being placed in general education settings. On top of that, the whole shift towards accountability and standardization has really made sure that students with disabilities are accessing the same curriculum or at least having access to the same curriculum as their non-disabled peers. So that's really shifted the expectation for teachers as well as for students in how students with disabilities in particular are accessing their education. And I'll speak more about that later today. I want to make sure Dr. Salikis has a turn to speak.
Yeah, thank you. Liz, I have a very quick question for you. I know we said we were probably going to hold the questions towards the end, but this particular question relates to what the statistics that you provided. So if you can just give us a quick, brief response, I will appreciate. And the question posed, it was, could this data be due to the fact that public schools tend to track the data compared to private schools?
Well, the shift is probably across public and private schools. I was referring to public school data in particular because those are the data that the Department of Education collects. But actually, I do believe that the same would apply in public schools, private schools, as well as charter schools. I wasn't going to get too deep into charter schools, but charter schools are kind of that in between. And we've actually seen a large increase in minoritized populations actually attending charter schools as well. So I didn't mean to emphasize that they were only growing in public schools. They're growing across school populations. Minoritized populations, particularly Hispanic learners, are growing across all school populations. However, the data that we have on file from the department that's currently was rotating in public schools.
Thank you. Thank you, Liz. Dr. Salikis, if you please go ahead and answer the first question.
Yes, of course. So one of the issues that are impacting is poverty. Poverty has been there and it's still there. And here in America, just in 2020, we are looking about 1 in 6 children are affected by poverty. They're living in poverty. In addition to that, there's an increasing gap between income, and there is a lot of children who live are homeless, others that are living with food insecurity. All these issues tend to inhibit their ability to feel safe, to feel that they're receiving good quality food, that they are able to receive health care, and that there is a level of stability. So when you translate all that, it impacts learning tremendously. So that is an issue that, you know, we want to look at, and that we want to find ways to help our schools and our teachers and help our families and help our students so that we can provide what we can. You know, with social justice is also about distributing resources in a way that is fair and equitable for everybody. And we know that technology is a great part of education. And when you have, you know, inequities with access to, you know, funding, and funding is low for certain schools in certain areas, you have students that are not able to work with technology, that it looks into also parent involvement. You know, people are prioritizing, of course, they value education, but they have to prioritize if they have to work one, two jobs. There's just a series, a lot of variables that contribute to the different decisions that impact parental involvement in schools, language barriers sometimes, and others. So this all adds and contributes to that background context that exists and the challenges that we're facing in our classroom settings.
Thank you both. And I just want to make a quick comment that is being added here by one of the participants. And she, I believe it's a she, so my apologies if I make that as an error. It says, my experience in our school district I've seen is that ESL students often are lumped in a special education as a catch-all classroom. So thank you for pointing that out. I think that really helped us to understand as well when we talked about social justice. So we'll continue to the next question. So we have seen that over the past several months, there has been an increased attention in the media to systematic biases and structural inequalities. So the question we would like to ask you both is, how do systematic biases and structural inequalities relate to children in public schools? Dr. Kramer, if you may go first.
Sure. So first of all, I want to talk about unconscious and implicit biases, because certainly biases exist that are overt and malicious, but I'm going to step away from those for a moment and talk about more of the unconscious or implicit biases that honestly we all here in this room probably have some, and we may or may not even be aware of them. So these refer to attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, our actions, our decisions, and we're not even aware that we're having these thoughts. We form expectations based on our unconscious biases, and they unknowingly affect our everyday perceptions, our judgments, our memories, and our behavior. So there's research out there that shows that before teachers even have a conversation with a student, they've already formulated a bunch of opinions about that student, very often based on their appearance, their race, their ethnicity, if they know anything about their home life or their family, based on a whole variety of factors that have very little to do with that student's actual potential or performance. And again, I'm not saying that it's intentional or malicious, but it's something that automatically happens. And what we probably all know as educators, when we have expectations for students, very often they become the reality. And if you're somebody sitting here thinking you have absolutely no biases, I actually encourage you to take the Harvard Implicit Bias Test. If you go ahead and Google that after this presentation, Harvard Implicit Bias Test, it's a free test you can take, and it measures implicit biases you may or may not be aware that you have. And you can do this based on race, ethnicity, gender, all different types of areas. And I have to tell you, you might be surprised about your results. I know I was. It points out to us things we might not even know about ourselves. So I think the first thing in understanding that, recognizing that, I'm not saying it's okay. I'm saying that awareness is one way we can try to take steps to kind of counteract some of those biases. We see it playing out in the school system. I'm going to link it back to special ed again, of course. But there was a study in 2016 where a researcher made up fake names of students and provided scenarios about struggling learners. And in these scenarios, the only thing she varied was the name of the student and the ethnic background. And she found that students that had names that sounded Hispanic versus students that had names that were described to have been African American versus students who were described to have been white, the teachers evaluated the students very differently on whether or not they probably needed to be referred out for special education services, or whether or not their behaviors or academic delays were so severe that they couldn't be just service with a little extra support. So, you know, there are research to show that this is still happening. If we look at the numbers of students who are referred to special education based on their ethnic or racial backgrounds, we see an overrepresentation of students from minoritized backgrounds in certain special ed categories. We see an underrepresentation of students from minoritized backgrounds being placed in classes for gifted or advanced placement classes. So it still exists. It still exists even in how teachers are promoted or hired within school systems. So we see this at all levels. We tend to see an affinity bias where people, whether that's teachers, administrators, other people in positions of power, tend to favor people who are most like themselves. We do this without even realizing this. So when we see the cultural dissonance or the differences between what the appearance or the culture is of the teacher or the general culture of the school or the administration team versus the culture of the students, we see that disconnect. You know, people are really at risk for this affinity bias, where if preference is given to people who look more like me or remind me more of myself, and we see a lot of difference between the schools or the teachers or the administrators and those of the students, these students are kind of already at a disadvantage then for being at risk for bias. If we look at just general structural inequalities that have existed in the schools for decades, school funding, as I'm sure you all know, is based on local property tax. So schools that are in less affluent neighborhoods, and I know my colleague was speaking about poverty a few moments ago, this really relates to overall inequities we find in schools or inequalities based on the amount of money available in schools based on the money generated by local property tax. And when we look at even large urban districts like Miami-Dade County Public Schools, where they kind of equalize that across the district and spread the wealth, so to speak, among schools in all different neighborhoods with all different tax brackets, we see that the priorities that schools need to spend their money on vary from place to place. So for example, if there's a finite pool of money that can be spent, but some schools need to spend more money on security, or some schools have maybe parents that are volunteering or PTAs that are raising a bunch of money and donating for funds, the schools are able to make different decisions about how they spend their money. And we see a much larger availability of gifted and AP programs or more enriching programs at schools that have a higher wealth of funds to be spent on discretionary items. So, you know, this is another way that this continues. I have a bullet point here, Courageous Conversations. And really what I wanted to just point out, and I think we'll probably talk about this more when we talk about social justice, but how important it is to really start addressing some of these conversations. I don't know, I hope I'm not offending anybody with anything I've said so far, but sometimes it gets a little uncomfortable to talk about some of these topics, particularly if we are feeling our own biases or concerned that there's things going on that aren't quite fair, or maybe with our colleagues, or even if our students are feeling less than welcome or less than equal. Really, to start having these open conversations, these difficult conversations, we call them courageous conversations in the literature, about addressing some of the ways that we as professionals feel, and teaching our students as well to address some of the ways they might be feeling about situations and about each other. So I turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you. So indeed, with systematic bias and structural inequities, that trickles straight right down to our children in our classrooms. Children lose their identities. They lose themselves. They struggle. They become oppressed, marginalized, or somewhat blurred in the process of their schooling. And this, in turn, results in children whose dreams are not visualized, and they fall right into the recurring patterns of discrimination and other issues in our society that kind of limit who gets access eventually to, good schools, who gets access to, for example, when they reach the high school level, algebra is a gateway classroom course. So access to that becomes limited as well. And so, we need to, as educators, be very mindful of these biases so that we can create environments that are allowing us to offer certain solutions for students to be able to express themselves and relate to the curriculum that is being given to them.
I just would like to say that as someone who really appreciates the reading from Paulo Freire, who is one of my favorite theorists, and he talks about empowering our students. I really appreciate the idea of the unconscious and the implicit biases, because that, I think, through us as teachers, we really need to be aware of the biases. So thank you for bringing that up. I think it also makes help us to develop that rapport that Maria, you were discussing, not only with our students, but also with the families and the communities at large. So I want to thank you both of you for that. There is a quick question that I would like to ask you both. This comes from one of the participants. And again, I'm sorry if I'm switching back and forth. I know we were going to do questions at the end, but I think some of these questions are appropriate at the time that we're now talking. And this question in particular, it says, as a white woman, how do you make your minority students as staff members feel comfortable with having these conversations? Are they open to it coming from you? Do you have African-American, Latin people in leadership to facilitate some of these diversity conversations?
I guess that's for me, because I was the one who spoke about that. So I will say, you know, I live in Miami, which is a very, very diverse environment, both at the university level among my college students, as well as the students in the K-12 schools where I did used to be an educator in an urban high school for a few years before I moved to the university. And I do a lot of research around culturally and linguistically diverse learners, or as now we're calling them, multiply marginalized populations. And I am a white woman, which in Miami is actually a big minority population versus the majority, which tend to be people of color. So it's not always comfortable, which is part of the process. So I think the best way that I'm able to have these conversations with colleagues or students is that we're all really upfront and honest from the beginning. We establish a community of trust. We establish some basic understandings and ground rules that, you know, we're all here for the good of all, that nobody is intentionally trying to hurt anybody's feelings, that if somebody's feelings are hurt, we're going to acknowledge it and deal with it, and that it's okay to be uncomfortable. And I think, you know, establishing that rapport, you know, Dr. Siddiqui's mentioned that between schools and families, but even among colleagues or, you know, between teachers and students, I think is critical. Once that rapport is there and there's a trust that it's coming from a good place and a place of moving toward an understanding, I think you'd be surprised how well these conversations could go. Now, that said, I do think it's important to include people of color in leadership positions within these conversations. So that might involve having pre-conversations before the large group conversation to enlist some volunteers from diverse perspectives to be voices that are heard in the conversation, even if not the facilitator, voices that certainly are heard so everybody hears a diversity of voices and feels comfortable speaking. But I think the first step would really be establishing that trust and setting the ground rules that everybody agrees upon about the real intentions and the ways we will address conflict if they arise.
So thank you. And I think there was a question very quickly because of something that you just said, Liz. Could you repeat the new term used now?
So, okay, my research looks at the overlap between race, ethnicity, language, poverty, and disability, among other markers. So we used to talk about this as students who are culturally and linguistically diverse with exceptionalities. The term that's being more used in the field now is multiply marginalized populations. If we look at all the different areas or markers of difference, whether it's age, gender, ethnicity, race, religion, ability level, those are all markers of difference. And the research I do looks at people who have differences in more than one category. So they might, let's say, be a student who's African-American, who lives in poverty, who is maybe transgender and also has a learning disability. Those are four different markers of difference. So we can call that multiply, that person is part of a multiply marginalized population.
Perfect. Thank you for clarifying that. So we now are going to move on to our third question. And this one pertains to considering all the issues taking place today. What are the most critical needs for diverse students?
Okay. I think I'm up first on this one.
You go first. Yes.
I'm not going to mute myself and be quiet. All right. So my first point here is access and equity. And I think the first point I really want to make is what I mean by equity, because a lot of times we use the terms equal or equality and equity interchangeably, when in fact they're not. So if we think about equal, equal is everybody has the same, whereas equity, everybody has what they need. And so an example I like to use, I'm going to pick on Dr. Taliki's right now. She has glasses and I don't. It's not fair, right? It's not fair that she gets to wear glasses to see this presentation and I just have to rely on my own eyesight. Well, the reality is I don't need glasses. So there's no reason for my, you know, for me to have to be provided with glasses to access this presentation. I can see just fine. That's what equity really boils down to in the schools. So a lot of times when we look at either students with disabilities or students who are struggling in a particular area, students who have a specific need, sometimes we see some backlash about people receiving something extra or different from others. But if everybody doesn't have that need, it's important that we're providing that need for those who have it. So that's what I mean by equity. Everybody's having what they need. When we talk about access, I have the bullet point here, free and appropriate public education. This is the hallmark of special ed, but it really applies to all students, that every student is receiving free, meaning of no cost, appropriate, meaning at the level that is required to best meet the needs of that student, public education. Now, certainly students can elect to have private education, but the right for a public education should be available to all. So the way I see that really coming into play in today's times is a couple things. So first of all, obviously, we're in the middle of a global pandemic. You know, things have shifted for every learner. And I know Dr. Saliki started referring earlier to technology, but really, I think this pandemic has shed light on the digital divide, on the people who have good access to technology, the students who have laptops and high-speed Wi-Fi at home, the students who have a skill set to learn online or to manipulate the technology, the students who live in a household with parents who can assist them in accessing their online learning versus students who lack these things. And I know a lot of school districts are providing technology to those who don't have it, but that doesn't mean the access to the same quality of technology still exists. And for students who are mostly learning at a distance right now, or at least somewhat at a distance, those who I think are at highest risk right now are students living in poverty who rely on a lot of services in their local schools, and students with disabilities who often have a lot of services besides just their instruction taking place during the school day. So as part of special education law, students with disabilities have related services that they are entitled to receive. And some of those are just not happening during COVID. It's impossible to do some of those remotely, or certainly to the same degree that they were having them in person, particularly related to behavioral support and counseling supports and things like that. So I think we're really looking at a concern about whether or not all students are having access to the services that they're entitled to having equitable participation in online education, and to having this access to what they're entitled to for their best needs. I want to touch back on accountability because I glazed over it earlier, but with this accountability movement, we've really seen a shift towards standardization of learning, which I'm not opposed to in theory, but the trouble is special education has always been focused on individualization of learning to meet the needs of each individual. And anytime we're going to have a Common Core or a learning pacing guide where all students in eighth grade in biology need to be studying this topic on this day, we're taking away the room for students to be learning at the rate, pace, or the content that's most appropriate for their education. So in a sense, the standardization movement or this accountability movement, I believe, is also interfering with students accessing a free and appropriate, the appropriate piece being the key term there, education, because their individual goals and needs are not necessarily being met to keep up with the accountability requirements that teachers and schools are really at. It's not an option for them to keep up with this accountability for their own accountability purposes, but I think it deters from the individual needs of our struggling learners.
Dr. Salikis.
So not just the curriculum, as Dr. Kramer so well expressed there, but also teacher practices. Teacher practices then become a very central part of how that curriculum is communicated to the students. I have that buzzword there, curricular relevance, but there's a lot that goes on behind that word. And when you get into deconstructing that word, it is very complicated. Gloria Lanson-Billings said teaching practices that explicitly engages questions of equity and justice so that the teacher is constantly in a self-reflective type of thinking and purposefully ensures that students have this access to the world that they need in order to be successful academically. And that's...
Yeah. Dr. Tsolikis, I wanted to follow up with two comments for you because I have seen some of the chat here and they are related in a way to your curricular relevancy idea. And one is, how can we promote in teachers that cultural proficiency for them to be able to relate to their students, and how we can somehow create a curriculum that is inclusive?
So I think that we go back to one of the very basic principles that I think we've been communicating is the trust and rapport with families and the communities. And I think that the community is a very important component. So reaching out and establishing, going beyond just that parent night that all schools typically require is highly critical so that there is a engagement from the community into the school and the school back into the community.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that additional information. So how can we as educators best provide for the needs of all our students? So I'm going to give you a minute to think to how can we provide what can we do to provide what our students need? So let's switch a little bit here. So Maria, you want to go first?
All righty. So bridges between school and teachers to families and communities are a big recurring theme in our conversation this afternoon. We cannot stress the importance of the community involvement and the reach out to the community and to the families and finding out where they're at and what are their needs, conversations that extend just beyond the parent-teacher conferences and the required events at the school are really critical. And so that's part of the conversations that we want to help and promote. Now, teacher preparation is another point that is very important to talk about, because when we are talking about providing teacher candidates and preparing educators to best serve those communities and those students in their classrooms, we want to make sure that teachers have not only a diverse perspective and not only an understanding of the different voices and diversity, but also to have a real core value that they are grounded in and that they, work with the students and the school to be able to, promote and support the learning needs of the students in their classrooms. And now, Dr. Kramer.
Thank you. So actually, my first bullet point really sort of continues the conversation we were having on the last slide when Dr. Tsolikis was talking about Gloria Ladson-Billings and, connecting with the students. So my suggestions are culturally responsive pedagogy or culturally relevant teaching. Sometimes it's referred to. Gloria Ladson-Billings is a big name in this field. So is Geneva Gay. And really what these strategies are, it's student-centered approach to learning in which the student's culture and cultural strengths are identified and nurtured to promote student achievement. It promotes a sense of well-being about the student's cultural place in the world and in your classroom. So some of the characteristics of CRP or CRT is positive perspectives on parents and families, like Dr. Tsolikis has been saying, the communication of high expectations, learning within the context of culture. So culture becomes the curriculum, tied to that curricular relevance that you were mentioning on the last slide as well. Student-centered instruction, culturally mediated instruction, a reshaping of the curriculum and the teacher as facilitator. So this culturally responsive teaching really empowers students socially, academically. It uses their cultural capital as a strength rather than a weakness. It makes connections between the home culture and the school culture. And I'll jump ahead also to teaching for social justice, which is tied very closely with culturally responsive pedagogy, but it takes it a step further. Instead of just recognizing and valuing and making curriculum relevant for students, the culture of the students in the classroom, it takes it a step further and really teaches students to act upon things. So Social justice is recognizing and acting upon the power that we have for making positive change. It's, the first step is, you know, students feeling engaged and welcome and recognizing our biases and connecting with families. But now we're taking it to another step. We're teaching students how to be change agents, how to ensure that positive change is happening, and how they can be participants, but also leaders in creating this change. So similar to culture responsive pedagogy, for teachers to become teachers for social justice, you first need to understand yourself. Who am I? What are my views? Do I notice inequities? How do I feel about them? Am I acknowledging my own privilege? Which, by the way, is another important piece I didn't mention earlier when somebody asked about how I, as a white woman, can lead a courageous conversation. I own my privilege. I know the privileges I bring to the table and the advantages I've had that maybe not all of my students or colleagues have. And I'm aware of that. And I, you know, I don't try to hide it or be ashamed of it, but I acknowledge that it's something that I experienced, which is different from somebody else's experience. And I acknowledge what can be done to address these inequities. So by knowing your own views and your students knowing their own views, you can recognize and accept the differences of yourself, of your students, of the families. So some suggestions for ways to kind of do this with your students is connect activities to real world problems, encourage students to express their multiple perspectives about things, take a look at fact and opinion. You know, there's so much going on in the climate in recent days, recent months, between what happened with George Floyd, the Black Lives Matter movement, even what happened with the election and fake news or alternative truths, and really, you know, having conversations with your students about how did this make you feel? How did, and it's okay to have differing views. Not everybody's going to agree, but for people to sort through what it means to have different views or have different facts. And if there's things that people feel are unjust or inequitable, teaching them they can do something about that. And creating an idea where students are all there to support each other, even if they have different views, kind of that team approach where they're making sure that each person in the class is going to be okay and doing what they can to support each person feeling valued and important. And, you know, these can be activities like writing letters to Congress as a class if there's an issue that they feel is unjust, or, you know, creating an article for the school newspaper about something that's going on that isn't quite right. Really putting that power and empowering the students, particularly the students who maybe are at most risk for feeling disconnected from the school, in not just being bothered by injustices they see, but by learning they can take some action to address that. So I'm going to be quiet now because I think it's time to move on.
I just want to thank you both because indeed you have provided us a lot of information to really ponder about. You know, I'm an educator, but I'm also a mother. So all these conversations that we're having is something that I also have as a mother, as I try to raise my child, to be, to understand social justice, to be, accept diversity, to include all type of individuals. So that's where I think also is important, the family environment, which is what you, Maria, were talking at the beginning. So thank you. And to also understand the diversity that you lived in, to understand your own biases that you, both of you pointed. So, and to having those key conversations, even if that is in your home as well. So thank you for pointing those key learning things. So before we move on into opening to questions, I just wanted to give you again some information about the master's programs that we have online. You have the information there, so I'm going to just read them quickly. And if you have any questions about the particular programs, you can always email us. You will see our emails are there, or you can even go to FIU online, and the information is also being posted right now on the chat. So the fully online master's programs are curriculum and instruction, curriculum development, curriculum and instruction in elementary education, educational leadership, higher education administration, and special education with autism endorsement. So at this point, I would like to make sure that we come ask more questions. I know that I've been adding some questions here and there, but this is your time to give us questions that you would like Dr. Kramer or Dr. Salikis to address. And let me see if I have, I think, a few of here. So let me see if this one. Don't you think that teacher preparation program need to be revamped so that equity is not a PD, but a basic one? Dr. Salikis, if you want to address that one.
Indeed, I think that, teacher preparation programs should go under ongoing monitoring of their programs, and they should, continuously think about, who is that teacher that they are preparing to be out there in our communities. And with the changing landscape in our nation, the changing landscape in our communities, I think that we have to make a conscious effort to make sure that our teachers are equipped with the appropriate skills, sets, and knowledge to be able to be successful with our students out there in our communities.
And if I could just put in a plug, I can tell you, Rose, that at FIU, equity is built into our teacher preparation programs at the pre-service and also in all the master's degrees that Flavia shared about a few moments ago. Equity is a huge piece of our programs here at FIU. And I know I actually teach a course all about that within our special ed master's program. It's not just, something we expect teachers to learn later. It's woven all throughout the coursework here at FIU. But yes, it's definitely important.
Thank you. So let me try to get to more questions. We have a variety of questions, but I'm trying to provide some that we have not discussed. Okay, so there is one, and then why don't the use of white supremacy come up as a major issue as an impediment to social justice? So Liz, I don't know, Maria, either one, please.
I'm not sure I understand the question, so I'll try to answer it, but I'm not sure I'm capturing what's being asked. So I think certainly when we look at social justice, we're addressing inequities, and I think certainly issues of white supremacy are a concern that can be addressed, certainly if there's current events happening like we've seen maybe in recent weeks and months related to that should be addressed in a conversation. But if I don't know if that's what, when you say white supremacy, if you mean like white supremacists, or if you're talking about how white is the culture of power, because that's a different answer. So I don't know if I'm answering the right question.
Liz, I don't mean to speak on behalf of Mr. Chase, but my interpretation, again, of that question, I guess it was more, yes, on the fact that the white culture could be considered, the white supremacy and more influential culture, and we're not being inclusive of other cultures. Again, that's my interpretation.
Okay, so that wasn't my initial, but I can answer. If that's the question, I can answer that too. So I think part of that, like I said, is addressing issues of privilege, of white privilege, and acknowledging that. There's actually a great article, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack, that I make all of my graduate students read, where we look at that issues of people from whatever the majority or dominant population group is, and how there's just certain privileges that we have that others don't have. And so I think part of social justice is acknowledging what exists and figuring out ways to make it more equitable. So I think it does come up, particularly around the areas of privilege and the areas of cultures of power. And I know you've mentioned Freire a couple of times already. He speaks about that. Funds of knowledge, cultural capital. I think all of that does come up, but I think it is certainly built into what we would address when we're looking at issues of inequity. Dr. Salikis, did you want to add something there?
Yes, I do. And I want to say that we also have to recognize the whiteness in the curriculum, which is a very important conversation to have, and how that in essence excludes populations from the whole entire history of things and other ideas and concepts.
Thank you both. And we have a few minutes left before the end of the webinar, but I have a question that I would like to pose to both of you. And this is regarding online learning and given the times that we're living, given COVID-19. So how do you think online learning is contributing to equity and access for diverse learners?
Repeat the question.
Of course. How do you think online learning is contributing to equity and access for diverse learners? Or if it's not, you know, we are in a discussion, we are open. So
I think it varies. I think I talked about earlier the digital divide and how some of our K-12 or P-12 students might be suffering because of this with less access. But I think for some people, particularly if we're talking like at the university level, like online learning, like an online program, like we all work in, I think in some ways it's actually making it easier for people to access their education, the availability of online programs. So people that might not have had the wherewithal or the time or the flexibility in their schedule, maybe people that are working or single parents or don't have as much leisure time to drive to a university or take classes that occur at a certain time of day. I think the flexibility of an online program, particularly in these crazy times where people sometimes are teaching and also at the same time homeschooling and also at the same time, you know, dealing with toddlers in the home, I think the ability to maybe do some of their own growth and learning online bridges that gap. So I think we see some positives and some negatives depending upon the population.
And I want to add that with online learning, there's a level of self-pacing. And for many individuals, that is a very good thing because they can manage their world. They have it more under their control.
Thank you. And I think it's interesting to see for me that I like to think about online learning, but it also I see it as a tool. So I think it's also good to, when we talked about online learning, to see what you both ladies were talking previously, which is the environment in where the child lives. So because that really influences whether online learning or not can facilitate their growth as they learn, whether they have the support, the technology, as you were saying. So it's interesting to also, when we talked about online learning, just to keep those factors in mind as you did. So thank you. I think we may have, I just want to make sure that we may have time for one last question before I just go into the final comments. So let me see. I'm trying to look at one last question. Okay. This one is more of a comment, but I think it resonates on perhaps what is expected on the teachers. And it says, it shouldn't always be the teacher's responsibility to educate on social, cultural issues, I would assume. So, and I wanted to bring that, it is a statement more than a question, but I think it has some important thoughts for us to discuss. Why is it that we always probably expect teachers to be the souls of teaching responsibility and social justice?
Do you want to go first, Maria, or do you want me to go?
Yeah, I'll start with a comment statement, of course. So indeed, there is also onus on the students. I'm looking at, you know, I'm just looking at the spread of students, right? K-12, your little ones, to, you know, all the, in the classroom settings. And there is also onus on our society. And I think that it is a, you know, to quote a very famous line, it takes a village, you know, but it really does. But I think that as educators and in education, we have a platform where we do have a responsibility to ensure that we do what we need to do to be able to and ensure students who grow up thinkers, who have a sense of individuality, who have a core value set, who participate in our democracy, and so forth.
Dr. Kramer?
So I think as teachers, for those of us who are teachers, we do feel it's our responsibility to make sure all our students are learning and feeling safe. And so I think when you have students who are students of color, students from minoritized populations, students who are struggling in one way or another to access the curriculum and learn, I think it actually is the teacher's responsibility to address the challenges that student is facing. And if one of the challenges that student is facing is, you know, a cultural disconnect or feeling that the relevance of what's going on is not related to them, or, you know, very unfair and hurtful things are occurring in their little world, I would argue that the learning and progress and even just behavior management, if you want to look at it from that, you know, ease of your day of having your students engaged and behaving and trying their best is just going to be so much easier for your own life. And the progress you're going to see for students is going to be so much better if they feel connected to you, your classroom, and what you're teaching. So no, you know, it might not be what you went to school to become a teacher for is to talk about these topics, but I would encourage people to keep an open mind and see how maybe making subtle shifts in the way you do things in your classroom to make students feel more supported and relevant and connected can be some small little baby steps you make can make a huge difference in their achievement and your ease of day as a teacher. So even if you don't feel it's your responsibility, I would encourage you to perhaps try just a couple of little things and see if it doesn't overall actually add to the quality of your classroom versus detract and add one more thing you have to do.
And hopefully by adding that culturally relevant teaching aspect into the programs, that will certainly will facilitate that teachers will be able to address these social issues in a more comfortable, you know, in a more prepared manner. So thank you. Thank you both of you for your feedback, your thoughts. Thank you for attending. I think that brings the end of our presentation. Thank you, Dr. Kramer. Thank you, Dr. Salikis. Thank you, Marianne Brown. Thank you for everyone being with us today. And let's continue this conversation, shall we? Have everyone a wonderful day.
Bye, everyone. Thank you, Flavia, as well.
Bye.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you would like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.